Do you believe that minerals management has adequately regulated blowout preventers?
No. The answer is no.
Interior Secretary Salazar faces questions at a Senate hearing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 18th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans pay their respects to Wally Hickel.
There's no question about it. The time that we worked together were some of the greatest days of my life.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says problems at the Federal Minerals Management Service may have contributed to last month's offshore oil rig disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Salazar testified before Congress today for the first time since the Deepwater Horizon sank on April 22nd. He says the responsibility is shared.
There had never been an incident like this. So did the country as a whole, the United States Congress, the Department of Interior, the oil and gas industry, and everybody else who's affected by this decision become lax? I would say yes. The answer is yes. And that's why it's important that there'd be a collective and shared responsibility relative to how we respond to the problem at hand.
Salazar says the Minerals Management Service, which oversees offshore oil and gas leases, needs a house cleaning. He says the president will call for an independent commission to look at the Gulf accident. It will be similar to those that investigated the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion and the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island.
In the case of the Challenger incident, it essentially put the Space Shuttle program on delay for about a 2.5-year period. In the case of the Three Mile Island investigation and the blow up of one of the reactors at Three Mile Island, it essentially shut down the nuclear industry for a period of 30 years. So how we handle this issue is one of highest importance.
Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon berated the MMS and accused it of being in denial about safety problems for years.
Do you believe that minerals management has adequately regulated blowout preventers?
No, the answer is no. I think that there is additional work that should have been done with respect to blowout prevention mechanisms. Obviously, there are multiple redundancies that are built in. This incident should never have happened because of the fail-safe kinds of procedures and redundancies that are in place, but it did happen.
Today's hearing focused on the deep water drilling done in the Gulf, but there are implications for development in shallow regions, including off Alaska. Shell plans to drill exploratory wells this summer in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and recently pledged increased safety measures like testing its blowout preventer once a week instead of once every 14 days. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, the Energy Committee's head Republican, asked about the difference between drilling in deep water versus shallow.
Do you envision a new, perhaps a more enhanced set of spill containment and response that is directed specifically to the deep water as a consequence of this tragedy?
Yes. The answer to that is yes, Senator Murkowski. I would envision that the 30-day report that we will deliver to the president will have a number of recommendations that deal with safety enhancements.
The report being prepared for President Obama is due later this month. The Interior Department repeated today that it's in a pause mode and that any decisions about permitting throughout the country, including Alaska, are on hold until after the report is finished. Former Alaska Governor Wally Hickel was buried today in a downtown Anchorage cemetery after a funeral that brought together Alaskans of all sorts. APRN's Steve Heimel has this report.
It was not a somber crowd. In fact, they were high-spirited, seemingly glad to see one another. And they were all there. The former governors, the congressional delegation, the large Hickel family, the close aides, developers from overseas, and a crowd of friends and foes from 70 years of political life going back to the statehood campaign. They filled the Catholic cathedral and stood along the walls, and they overflowed into a building next door, paying their last respects to a man who was twice governor, interior secretary, builder, and founder of civic and policy organizations. There were 24 years between Hickel's terms as governor. His outsider bid in 1990 was a surprise success. He had to put a team together quickly to run the government, and one person he turned to was Fairbanks lawyer Charlie Cole to be attorney general. Cole says instead of the hard-boiled businessman he expected to be working for, he found Hickel to be a person basically in love with Alaska.
He truly and deeply loved the state of Alaska. He loved its land. He loved its people. He loved its culture. And he loved its environment. And I miss him.
University of Alaska Anchorage Chancellor Fran Ulmer said Hickel was able to listen to those he disagreed with and decide what was truly in the best interest of the state. She cited a time when she was in the legislature pushing a bill she was afraid he would veto.
I'd introduced a bill requiring that insurance companies cover mammograms. The insurance industry was opposed to it. They asked Wally Hickel to veto my bill. I asked for, and he gave me, a chance to go into his office and talk to him about how it would save lives and save money. And he changed his mind, and he didn't veto the bill.
She said if Wally Hickel is still fighting for us in heaven, she hopes he will send us politicians who are statesmen. Ted Stevens and Hickel were statehood boosters together. When Senator Bob Bartlett died suddenly in 1968, Hickel appointed Stevens to replace him, starting the longest term ever served by a Republican in that body.
But I've got to tell you, there's no question about it that the time that we worked together when he was governor, when he was Secretary of Interior, and when I was there in the Senate, when he was really still boosting Alaska, were some of the greatest days of my life.
As President Richard Nixon's Interior Secretary, Hickel found himself becoming an environmentalist. He protected whales, and when an oil rig exploded in the ocean off the coast of Santa Barbara, he cracked down on the oil industry. He disagreed with Nixon over the issue of the Vietnam War and the bombing of Cambodia, and Nixon fired him over it. Before he became governor for the second time, Hickel actively invested in getting a natural gas pipeline built to Valdez, an idea he pushed along with former Governor Bill Egan. Former Hickel aide Jeff Lowenfels, who later became president of their Yukon Pacific Corporation, had a telling anecdote about being in Houston for talks with oil company executives and deciding to go out for the afternoon.
When we were wearing our suits and our ties, and we walked into this movie theater in Houston with, you know, people wearing regular clothing, and they were staring at us the whole time. I had no idea what the movie was. It turned out to be The Killing Fields. Not a particularly happy movie, and certainly not one that Governor Hickel was expecting to see. And after the movie was over, everybody got up. Wally Hickel was sitting there saying, "I told Nixon not to do that," with tears running down his face.
At the reception, Hickel, quotes, abounded, builded or I will, to the oil companies. "I have an idea. Why war? Why not big projects?" And of course, the little man inside he often spoke of who guided him. His close friend Max Huddle says he's sure Hickel now truly knows who the little man is. There will likely not be another time when a crowd like that at Wally Hickel's funeral comes together again. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a spelling bee for adults? In Sitka, it's a tradition. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The first-degree murder trial of Rachelle Waterman has been delayed a week and could be put off for months. A request to reschedule the trial was the subject of a status hearing yesterday in Ketchikan Superior Court. Also Monday, the court briefly heard from Waterman's two alleged co-conspirators, one of whom agreed to testify at Waterman's trial. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
Waterman is accused of conspiring to kill her mother with Kluwak resident Jason Arendt and Craig resident Brian Raydell. Both men pled guilty in 2004 to the first-degree murder of 48-year-old Lori Waterman. Rachelle Waterman's first trial was held in Juneau and ended in a hung jury. She was scheduled to be retried in Ketchikan on June 1st. Her attorney, Stephen Wells, has asked that the trial date be put off until the end of August. Wells says he has another trial set to begin this week in Anchorage, which he expects to last at least until June 7th. The state is opposing Wells' request to delay the trial. Superior Court Judge William Carey Monday was reluctant to agree to a delay beyond 1 week. Carey said he would revisit the trial date at another hearing next week. Also Monday, the court heard from alleged co-conspirators Raydell and Arendt. Both men have been subpoenaed to testify in the Waterman case. They participated in Monday's hearing telephonically. Raydell told the court that he intends to comply with the subpoena, but Arendt said he would not.
I cannot control where I am moved, sir, but I will not testify under any circumstances.
Judge Carey ordered that Arendt be moved to Ketchikan for the trial in the event that he decides to testify. If not, Carey agreed to allow previously taped testimony from Arendt to be played at this trial. Another status hearing in the Waterman case is scheduled for May 26th. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Frustration deepens daily for Gulf Coast residents waiting for a remedy to the blowout that continues to spew crude oil into the ocean. By now, millions of gallons, coupled with huge amounts of toxic dispersants are mixed into the water column, and people there are helpless to stop the assault on their marine livelihood. But they are doing what they can, and part of that is reaching out to others who have experience with spill disasters. Members of the University of Alaska's Marine Advisory Program just returned from a trip there to advise marina owners, fishermen, and charter captains about spill aftermath. Tori Baker is with the program and was in the fishing industry in Cordova during the 1989 Exxon Valdez spill. She says this Gulf spill is affecting millions more people than the Exxon Valdez disaster, and there are other differences, too.
Whereas commercial fishing is the heartblood of our coastal communities and a big chunk of our state economy, down there, I think you can just sort of flip it 180 degrees, and the charter boat tourism and tournament industry down there is absolutely humongous. And I think that those folks were the ones that really are up against it in terms of feeling immediate fallout. While we were there, a number of these, you know, $1 million, $2 million prize tournaments were being canceled in Louisiana. So those folks feel like, unfortunately, speaking of storms, they feel like they're really up against a perfect storm of events here, where they were poised and ready to get back onto their businesses, and this thing is really wreaking havoc with all of the recreation business, as well as the on and off fisheries closures for the commercial side.
And as you mentioned, these folks are just 5 years out from Katrina, Hurricane Rita. What sort of disaster fatigue do people have there? Do they have ideas about how to adjust, or are they just in shock?
I think what we found is that, for the most part, people are really in shock. I think, really, this one is so categorically different. You have here a huge technological disaster that I think is affecting the the particularly on a community level in a different way. With a natural disaster in general, you have a little bit of a warning, you know it's coming, you have some experience in that region with major storm events. But with this one, I think where they're really asking and where it's hitting them right between the eyes is the business impacts and litigation. And, fortunately, I guess we were able to share with them our 20-year litigation experience, talked to a seventh-generation fish processor who just said, boy, I employ 90 people and I'm, with these closures, I'm going to have to let them go. And am I going to be able to hold on?
And, Tori, this is a completely different set of circumstances, of course, than the Exxon Valdez disaster. But you were in the fishing industry in 1989 and in Cordova during that time. What was it like for you personally to be in the Gulf and experience what these folks are going through now? Were there some comparisons emotionally, or how would you characterize it?
Well, yeah. I think I really made a calculated decision, on a very personal level before I jumped into this. I was torn between the fact that I felt morally obligated based on my experience. I think what I was pleased to see in certain ways was that, these folks have a lot of tools at their disposal. One of the things that we said to them was that one of the first things we did in 1989 was order 10 fax machines at one of our local municipal offices, because the level of communication was nothing what it is now with the web, with YouTube, with cell phones. But what I found as I went down there was that there was, aside from the huge amount of panic, there was a great sense of not knowing what was going on in terms of the mixes of dispersants, of what the 12-hour updates are on some of the planning information that does go around the incident command centers. That didn't seem to be getting down to the folks in the state agencies as quickly as they would want.
Tori Baker is with the University of Alaska's Marine Advisory Program. Usibelli Coal is taking steps toward expansion. The locally owned mining company, which operates Alaska's only coal mine, has begun work to access a new deposit near its Healy site. Usibelli Vice President of Business Development Steve Denton says the company is targeting a reserve called Jumbo Dome, about 5 miles from its current operation at Two Bull Ridge.
It's just the next place we need to go to when we're played out in Two Bull Ridge. We're building a road right now, starting to build a road in there. We have permitted the road and have submitted a permit application for the mine.
Denton says the Jumbo Dome mine permit application covers an estimated 70 million tons of coal, twice the size of the Two Bull Ridge Reserve it's been mining since the late 1990s. He anticipates it will take 2 to 3 years to complete the access road, which will traverse a mountain pass. Usibelli is also putting in an access route to explore a coal prospect near Palmer. Denton says the company has had the Wishbone Hill property since 1997 and is reassessing the potential of mining a high-quality coal deposit there. He says both Usibelli projects reflect expected growth in the export market for coal.
Many countries, primarily in the Southwest Pacific, India, Indonesia, China, that whole area down in that part of the world is growing economically, going from third world status to much higher standard of living for the people there, and it requires a lot of energy. So coal is probably going to make up a large portion of their increased energy demand.
Usibelli exported about half of its 1.8 million ton production last year to Chile, Korea, and Japan. The rest of the coal was burned in interior power plants. Denton says energy demand is just part of the economic forecast and cautions that the market for coal could falter due to concern about CO2 emissions and global warming.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Spring planting season is here, and Matanuska Valley potato farmers are getting ready to plant for this year's crop of spuds. But Barb Hansen, an inspector with the State Division of Agriculture in Palmer, says growers need to be sure their seed potatoes are certified disease-free. Hansen says certified seed potatoes will help ensure that late potato blight does not take hold in Alaska. That's the disease that caused the Irish potato famine.
Late blight is a fungal disease of potatoes, and it's quite common down in the lower 48 states, and it's not ever got a foothold in Alaska yet. We've had a couple of incidents, small-scale incidents of it, but we're hoping to keep it out of the state by regulating import of seed potatoes.
Hansen says the fungus attacks the plant and causes lesions, which burst. Spores are then windborne, which causes the disease to spread quickly. Spores can hide in the soil, and wet summers can intensify the risk of the disease. Late blight also attacks tomato plants. Hansen says most valley farmers have certified seed stock, but even backyard gardeners need to follow the same rule.
We also encourage people strongly not to plant table stock potato that they have bought from the store, from the grocery store, and plant that, because those potatoes are not certified seed. They're not proven to be disease-free, and they can introduce a lot of diseases, not just late blight, but all sorts of other devastating diseases into their gardens and into Alaska soils.
Buyers need to check for a certificate that the seed stock is disease-free when purchasing seed potatoes from a nursery. Flocks of Bethel residents came out yesterday for the annual Breakup Bash. The party commemorates the start of the summer season. From member station KYUK, Shane Iverson reports.
Catching the moment that the ice first begins to shift can take a lot of tenacity, or just luck, like in the case of Wilson Nanning, who pulled up to his office at just the right time.
I saw the tripod passing and I said, oh shoot, I need to take pictures. So I pulled in to start taking pictures as quickly as I could.
The Ice Classic tripod tripped at 8:41 on Monday morning when the ice sheet in front of Bethel began moving downriver. When the evening crowd showed up to celebrate, chunks of ice and puddles of water rested seemingly motionless, not quite as impressive as some past years. Bethel's Michael Bialy looked out at the scene and thought of how it could be more exciting.
People getting crushed by the ice, swimming in ice-cold water, people going onto the ice and jumping into the water. Someone dropping a giant rock onto the ice and making the ice crack. Yeah, it'd be much better like that.
So Bialy's idea of a fun breakup is a touch dangerous, but he says he's pent up after a long, windy winter.
I didn't spend much time outside.
And when Bialy ventured out to go sledding, there was hardly any snow.
Well, when I went down a hill, it was not really that fast. And when I'd ever go on a bump, and I was crashing, either hit my sister's head or my cousin's leg.
Musician Zach Fairbanks takes to the stage, which is actually a flatbed truck that's been pulled up to the seawall. Further down the bank, Nook Leonard was sitting on the seawall, looking at the rotted sheets and thinking of good times ahead.
I'm excited about springtime because there's only one solution. Me and my brother get to go to our fish camp.
A gray cloud rolls over the bash. Rain begins sprinkling the crowd. Leonard takes a last look at the river before running off.
It's kind of sad to see winter go. But you know, there's always a winter ahead.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
In Sitka, Kettleson Memorial Library held its annual Adult Spelling Bee on Sunday afternoon. The words ranged in difficulty from carnage and vulgar to ennui and macaque. As KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, winner Paul Norwood might have had a unique advantage.
Paul Norwood's path to victory included the words bungalow and daffodil, as well as shibboleth, and this word.
Sobriquet.
That's sobriquet. It means nickname. It's French. And we'll let Norwood tell you why the crowd is groaning.
I'm from Paris.
He's from Paris. Norwood is 30. He started learning English in middle school, moved here about 10 years ago. At the spelling bee, he also got the words bouillon and chauffeur. It's hard to say whether the French words gave Norwood any advantage. After all, runner-up Peter Apathy dealt with avoirdupois.
A-V-O-I-R-D-U-P-O-I-S.
And gendarme.
Gendarme. G-E-N-D-A-R-M-E.
Apathy and Norwood advanced together into a list of words so hard, both of them kept getting things wrong.
L-A-N-Y-A-P-E-C-U-R-I-B-R. D-I-T-H-A-R-A-G-M.
Until the judges decided to move them back to an easier list, and that's where Norwood won. Not with a French word, but with a bird name, ptarmigan.
P-T-A-R-M-I-G-A-N.
Nice.
The adult spelling bee, which was held at Kettleson Memorial Library, started last year as a fundraiser for libraries in Guatemala, says Library Director Sarah Jones.
This year's event raises money for libraries in Haiti because, as most people know, they have done pretty well securing their collections now, but the buildings in most cases are either collapsed or unsafe.
32 people entered the event at $20 a pop, so that's more than $600 there. But the grand total of what the spelling bee raised won't be known until after the accompanying bake sale money is counted. Some entered in teams, some just competed by themselves. They could even use lifelines, like phoning a friend or asking a member of the audience to spell the word, although that provided only limited assistance. Here's someone asking for help on the word quinoa.
Somebody help me out.
Somebody back there.
Q-U-I-N-O-A.
Q-U-I-O-N-A. Oh!
Ah, well. That contestant, like so many others, took even defeat with a sense of humor. Reporting in Sitka, S-I-T-A-K, S-I-K-A-T, nope. S-I-T-K-A? I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.